This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
الحمد لله رب العالمين ونبيه ورسوله الأمين اللهم صل وسلم وبارك على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين وصحبه الطيبين ومن تبعهم بإحسان إلى يوم الدين أما بعد Our community, like many other communities in the world of the Ahlul Sunnah wal-Jama'ah, had scarcely been aware that there exists a phenomenon such as the Shia until some 3 decades ago. For the time that we had spent at the southern tip of Africa, ours was a matter of survival. We had to survive and preserve our aqidah against overwhelming odds. At the time, it was all we could do just to preserve our kalima la ilaha illallah Muhammadur Rasulullah. We thank Allah Ta'ala and we praise Him for having enabled our forefathers to have held on to that under the threats and under the challenges that they faced. But the passage of time brings its own challenges. So suddenly the time was here when early in the 20th or late in the 20th century, from the middle of the 20th century onwards, we started facing a number of threats, a number of new challenges, some of which were old and some of which were new. There was the Baha'i threat, there was the Qadiani menace, and along with these, in the passage of time, also came along the Shia. Now, from a community that some 20, 30 years ago barely knew anything, barely knew that there's something in Islam called Shiism and there's a group of people called the Shia. From a community such as that to have grown into a community in which Shiism has become a factor to contend with. In a community such as this, it is natural that we are going to ask certain questions. One of the prominent questions that we are going to ask is why? Why is it that there is a migration from within our ranks to their ranks? Much of what we have been doing over the past how many weeks? 20 odd weeks or so. Much of what we have been doing is to search for an answer for why does it happen. The reason why we engage in it, we understand ourselves well enough. We have a duty to preserve our aqidah, we have a duty to preserve stability, to keep our turbulence out of our communities, and therefore we engage in this particular investigation. But when we ask the question, why do people from this side of the divide cross over to that side of the divide, there is any number of reasons that you can put to it. Tonight I just want to briefly tabulate some of them and then go into the depth of one of those reasons. Scan a few reasons, briefly discuss them. One of them I want to discuss in some detail. First and foremost, there exists the idea with some people that there is this divinely appointed bloodline from Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and after him there is this divinely appointed bloodline, and these are the only people enabled and authorized by Allah Ta'ala to lead. You will see the idea of a bloodline cropping up once again in these video clips that have been going around. What do they call them? Rivals. The idea of a bloodline. That there is a group of people that share a particular bloodline, descended from one another, and they alone have the authority and have been enabled by Allah Ta'ala to rule. Now this bloodline is normally juxtaposed and compared against the bad bloodline. The good bloodline on the one side, the bloodline of light, and the bloodline of darkness. In the arrivals, which are the two that are pitted against one another? We find this particular bloodline of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, and the bad bloodline is very, very 20th century, 21st century George Bush and his ancestors. Fits very, very snugly into the 20th and 21st century. As for the other bloodline, the goat bloodline, that existed once upon a time, and at the moment the only existence that there is a claimed or assumed existence of the 12th Imam, who is hidden and is supposed to come back. Because of a failure to find any other similar kind of bloodline, they have latched onto this particular one. The fact of the matter is that the descendants of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam are many more than that one particular bloodline. You find them all over the world, sometimes through descendants, and sometimes those who merely claim descent from that high and noble lineage. However, what I want to say here is that classically seen, those who postulated the idea of a bloodline, who said there are certain people only, chosen and selected by Allah Ta'ala, authorized and enabled by Allah Ta'ala to fulfill this particular function, they had to juxtapose this bloodline against another bloodline. And it was what? It was Banu Hashim on the one side and Banu Umayyah on the other side. And the legends go back how the two were born, Abdul Shams and Hashim were born as twins, and that story goes on. We discussed some of it once upon a time. The one still was attached to the other's forehead, it had to be cut apart, and someone remarked that when two kids have to be cut apart, they will forever live in violence with one another. Those are the kinds of urban legends or historical myths that get woven around this kind of story. What I want to say about the bloodline issue, about Banu Umayyah on the one side and Banu Hashim on the other side, are two things. One of it I have said already, the other is a new contribution tonight. From the one side, the fact is, the historical fact is, that if Banu Umayyah was such an evil bloodline, why do we find such a lot of intermarriage between the family of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam on the one side and Banu Umayyah on the other side? Banu Umayyah is not just Muawiyah and Yazid. Banu Umayyah is also Uthman ibn Affan, who married two of the daughters of Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam. It is also Uthman's son Amr ibn Uthman and his descendants who married the daughters of Hassan and Hussein radiyallahu anhum. So there was a lot of intermarriages between the Ahlul Bayt and Banu Umayyah. These are not the only ones, there are several other ones. That is the one thing. The other point that we wish to make here is that something happened in the year 132 after the Hijrah. You know, Banu Umayyah ruled from the year 40. From the year 40 after the Hijrah, when Muawiyah became Amir al-Mu'mineen due to the agreement reached between him and Sayyidina al-Hasan ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib radiyallahu anhum. That was in the year 40. 92 years later, 132, the last of the Umayyad Khalifas would be killed and assassinated. He was Marwan II, called Marwan al-Himar. That was the end of the Umayyad Khilafah. And from that time onwards, in the eastern wing of the lands of Islam, there was no trace of Banu Umayyah any longer. One branch of the Umayyad escaped to Spain, and there they continued an Umayyad Khilafah for a while. But that Umayyad Khilafah had nothing to do with the Shia whatsoever. They were neither good to the Shia nor bad to the Shia, because there were no Shia in Spain. 132, the Umayyads disappear from the scene. The Umayyads disappear from the scene to be supplanted by the Abbasids. Now what happens to the idea that there's a good bloodline against a bad bloodline? Once a bad bloodline has been removed, the rug has been pulled from beneath the argument that says that there will be forever a titanic struggle between this bloodline and that bloodline. There's no such a thing as a bloodline here. In our Sharia it is, مَنْ بَطَّأَ بِهِ عَمَلُهُ لَمْ يُسْرِعْ بِهِ نَسَبُهُ. If your deeds keep you behind, if your deeds are evil and they keep you behind, the fact that you are the son of so-and-so won't take you further. Our Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam told his daughter Fatima that I won't be able to do anything for you. He said that if my daughter Fatima had to steal, لَقَطَعْتُ يَدَهَا, I myself will cut her hand. So, piety and status with Allah Ta'ala is not by descent, because إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ عِنَّ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ. Whether you are from Banu Hashim, whether you are from Banu Umayyah, whether you are a Persian, or whether you are an African, it doesn't matter where you are descended from. So for a period of time, for that particular century, while Banu Umayyah was in power, the idea of a good bloodline as opposed to the bad bloodline might have had some attraction. It might have impressed certain people. But what do you do when Banu Umayyah disappears from the scene? What do you do on top of it when they are supplanted by a new dynasty who are your own cousins from Banu Hashim themselves? The new rulers are who? They are the sons of Abbas ibn Abdul Muttalib. They are also from Banu Hashim. So you can't say, well, it's Banu Hashim against Banu Umayyah because something new has happened now. Banu Hashim is ruling. It just happens to be the Abbasid branch of Banu Hashim and not the Talibi branch of Banu Hashim. It's a different branch of Banu Hashim. More, inshallah, will be said about this in due time to come. That was the one reason though. When we ask, why are people attracted to the other side? Is this attraction to the family of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam? The idea of the bloodline, might have held a certain validity once upon a time. But in 132 after the Hijrah, that bloodline idea disappears. And that claim can no longer stand. So what's the second reason why people would be attracted? The second reason why people would be attracted is something which we have been spending a lot of time on. Much of the time that we have been spending lectures here is to do with this. Textual arguments. In other words, arguments from the Quran and the Sunnah that, from the Shia perspective, indicate that Ali ibn Abi Talib is the rightful ruler and the Ahlul Bayt have a certain status. Now, to repeat all those arguments and the counter-arguments, that would be counterproductive at this moment. We've done it. The CDs are available. Anyone wants to get into the details of what is really meant when Allah Ta'ala says, إِنَّمَا يُرِيدُ اللَّهُ لِيُذْهِبَ عَنْكُمُ الرِّجْسَ أَهْلَ الْبَيْتِ. What is meant when Allah Ta'ala told Ibrahim alayhi salam, إِنِّي جَعِلُكَ لِلنَّاسِ إِمَامًا. What is meant by يَا أَيُّهَا الرَّسُولُ بَلِّغْ مَا أُنزِلَ إِلَيْكَ مِنْ رَبِّكَ. What is meant by إِنَّمَا وَلِيُّكُمُ اللَّهُ وَرَسُولُهُ. And all the other hadith, that's done already. We won't get into that. I think we've spent quite a few man hours responding to those particular arguments. So both the idea of Hashimite descent and the idea of Quran and Sunnah says the Shia are right, therefore the Shia are right, both those arguments hold very little water in the final analysis. The 20th century specifically, and especially the second half of the 20th century, has been a time of upheaval. A time of upheaval, more importantly, a time of revolution. All over the world, not just the Muslim world, all over the world, there were new political developments taking place. And there was the idea of third world countries shaking off the yoke of the oppressor, shaking off the yoke of the colonialist usurper and gaining independence for itself. At a time such as this, in the post-colonial period, as we were shaking off the, we looked at the idea of justice, social justice. Justice to be done in society, doing away with oppression. And here people look back and they found that within Shiism specifically, they thought that they saw a good ideal of standing up for justice. But where within Shiism? Where within Shiism do they find that particular ideal of standing up for justice? That is a very, very atomistic approach to things. In other words, you're only looking at a certain thing and you forget the entire backdrop against which it happens. The history of Shiism is a long and rich history. The history of Shiism is not just what happened at Karbala. When they speak about standing up for justice, there's only one thing that they are speaking about. Hussein against the armies of Yazid at Karbala. But is that all that Shiism was about? Shiism was about much more than that. Some of which we have attempted to make clear the week before the last lecture, and those before it as well. Shiism is much, much more than Karbala alone. Shiism also has within itself a long history of treason and betrayal. Shiism also has within itself a history of falsely ascribing things to the Ahlul Bayt and creating an entire alternative religion on that particular basis. There's a lot of falsehood, there's a lot of treason, there's a lot of betrayal involved in what Shiism is all about. So, when we look back and we say, well, there is a person, Hussein stood up for justice. Hussein stood up for justice, but Hussein is not Shiism. Hussein is not Shiism. Who are the Shia in Karbala? The Shia are those people who invited Hussein. The Shia are the people who at the last moment betrayed Hussein. The Shia are the same people a few years later would betray his grand, his great grandson, Zayd ibn Ali ibn his grandson rather, Zayd ibn Ali ibn Hussein. The Shia are those same people on account of whom the Imams themselves would say, as Abdullah Mamaqani records on the authority of Abu Amr al-Kashi, he says that the Imam, it's either Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, Ja'far al-Sadiq says, مَا أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ آيَةً فِي الْمُنَافِقِينَ إِلَّا وَهِيَ فِي مَنْ يَنْتَحِلُ مَوَدَّتَنَا. There's no ayah, no sign which Allah Ta'ala revealed about the munafiqeen, except that you would find it in those people who claim to love us. The Shia claim to love the Ahlul Bayt. Within them, says the Imam himself, within the books of the Shia, every sign of a munafiq you will find amongst these people. They have been sitting back, resting on their laurels, and saying that we are the Shia of Al Muhammad. We are the supporters, we are the partisans of the family of Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So, the idea of social justice, the idea of standing up against tyranny, the idea of standing up against a tyrant ruler such as Yazid, yes, it might resonate well, but it does not give an apt and adequate reflection of the history of Shiism. From when? From its earliest days up to the present day. Up to the present day. So the idea of standing up for justice, if one wants to see standing up for justice, you would find much, much more in terms of standing up for justice within the history of the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, in the history of the Tabi'een, in the history of the ulama and the imma of the Ahlul Sunnah wal Jama'ah, much richer than what the Shia have to offer. Karbala might be a very prominent event, it is also a very lone event, because after Karbala, not a single one of the line of the Imams of the Sa'ashariyah ever attempted to revolt against any ruler ever again. All of them were pacifists, not because they were cowards, rather because they realized that the kind of people who claim that they are their supporters are the people who will turn around at the drop of a hat and say that, no, we have nothing to do with you. The problem was not with the Ahlul Bayt, the problem lay with the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. So we've looked at three reasons so far. First of all, Hashimite descent. Secondly, the Quran and the Sunnah. None of those two gave any credence to the beliefs of the Shia that we have something called Imamah and that it's institutionalized within either the Quran or the Sunnah. And thirdly, even the idea, even looking for a symbol for social justice, if that symbol is to be found in Sayyidina al-Husayn ibn Ali's martyrdom at Karbala, it is lone, it is isolated, and it does not represent Shiism and the Shia. By far, the most powerful factor that attracted people to Shiism within the last 20-30 years, in fact, I would probably go to the extent of saying in the entire history of Shiism, has to be the Iranian Revolution of 1979. It has to be the Iranian Revolution. No other single factor has contributed to the spread of Shiism in the manner that the Iranian Revolution has. It is comparable. Is comparable to only one instance in history, and that is the Safavid Revolution in Iran 500 years before Khomeini's revolution. And that Safavid Revolution, I've made reference to it several times, I will repeat it. What happened actually there? A land that had 80% Ahlus Sunnah inhabitants was turned into a land that now has 80% Shia inhabitants. How was that achieved? By force, by exile, by removing the elite, by removing the scholars, and over a period of 200 years gradually indoctrinating a leaderless public. That was, in its time, 500 years ago, the most powerful factor that swelled the ranks of the Shia. Never before had the Shia had such a period of flourishing as under the Safavids. Because they had a country of their own. They had a state of their own. All the apparatus of state were in their hand, so they could do what they needed to do. And then 500 years later, there came the Iranian Revolution. Now, this is the one that we want to look at in greater detail tonight. The questions we want to ask about the Iranian Revolution is, what caused the Iranian Revolution? Was it Shiism per se? Was it the belief of the people in Shiism? Was it the fact that the people believed in Imamah? That they believed in infallible Imams? That they believed something about the Quran and something about the Sunnah. Was it all of that that led to the culmination and of that revolution that took place in 79? Or was it merely the coincidence of a number of circumstantial factors? Is it schism that created the revolution, or is it the combination of a whole lot of economic, political and social factors that took place within the first half of the 20th century that led to this particular revolution? If it had to be Shiism, if it had to be the Aqeedah of the Shia that led to the creation of the Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979, then I would think that it should have taken place 1,000 years earlier. Because the Shia have been around for so long. They held those beliefs from a long time ago. It didn't just come about overnight. Khomeini did not discover Shiism. Khomeini was a very late adherent of Shiism. So it cannot have been the idea that the Shia have about politics, governing, governance and government. Cannot be that. Let's just quickly go back to our very first lecture and say, what is Shiism all about? Shiism is about Imamah. What is Imamah? Who rules the Muslim community? What does Shiism teach about rulership? What does Shiism teach about who stands at the head of the community? They say at the head of the community stands the Imam. When? Not just in after Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam's time, for those few years. From that time till the day of Qiyamah, the community can only be ruled by a divinely appointed Imam who must be one of 12. Either Ali, or his son Hassan, or his son Hussein, or his son Ali, or his son Muhammad. Sorry, Hassan, Hussein were brothers. And then from Hussein onwards, it is son, father to son, father to son, until it eventually reached Al-Hassan Al-Askari. And after him, they say, the only one who has the legitimate right to rule the Ummah, to lead the Ummah, to govern and be at the head of affairs, is the hidden Imam, no one else. So when the hidden Imam disappeared in the year 265 after the Hijrah, they said, what do they do then? They said, we wait for him to come back. He is coming back. So 265 became 266, 266 became 300, it became 500, it became 900, it became 1200, it's already 1400, he is still not back. Let's just look at that long period of 1200 years of history in terms of politics, in terms of government and governance. What beliefs and what teachings did the Shia espouse during that entire period? Having already committed themselves to an idea that only the Imam can rule, they found themselves in a bit of a quandary. What do they do? Because it's not the Imam that's ruling first, it's Abu Bakr that's ruling, and then Umar, and then Uthman. And then Sayyidina Ali ibn Abi Talib ruled for a brief period, 4 or 5 years, and then his son Hassan for about 6 months, and that was the last that the Shia had in terms of governing the Ummah. Never again did any member of that particular line of the Ahlul Bayt rule the Ummah. We know the reasons why. The reasons why didn't anyone of them aspire to take the reins of government again? If we have to ask the Shia, why didn't they? Well, asking a Shia in the street won't be a very, very good answer. We won't get a very good answer. Ask the books of the Shia, the legacy, the ahadith of the Shia, of the Imams, then you will remember the hadith that I recalled 2 weeks ago, that the Imam said, if I had as many followers as there are black sheep in that particular flock there, then I would start a revolution. And they counted, they could barely count a dozen. Because simply they couldn't rely upon their followers. They knew that these followers are up to no good. There were some very, very painful lessons that were learned at Karbala and by Zayd ibn Ali and by all the other members of the Ahlul Bayt who had ever revolted against the Khulafa of their time. So they knew this was not for them. They devoted themselves to a life of piety, a life of ibadah, a life of scholarship. And they had nothing to do with the politics of their time. They lived a life of withdrawal. From the Shia side, they were just biding their time. The Imam, they say the Imam is not just the political ruler, he is in charge of every atom of this universe. So he has to exist in order for everything else to exist. If there is no Imam, nothing will remain in existence any longer, because heaven and earth cannot exist without this Imam. So do not be naive, they tell us, to think that the function of an imam is only to be the head of government. No, the function of an imam is to run the entire universe. So he has to be there, even though he is sitting in political withdrawal in his house, be it in Medina, be it in Karbala, be it in Najaf, wherever it might be, but they lived in this withdrawal. While they were living in withdrawal, they were running the entire universe. Fine. Then thereafter, 265, the last of the imams disappear, and they say his son goes into occultation. As he went into occultation, supposedly, allegedly goes into occultation, the Shia then formulate a theory. This theory is called the theory of intidhar. What's intidhar? Waiting. Now the word waiting, intadhara, yantadhari, something means to wait. With the Shia, it came to mean a specific policy that dictates behavior in the absence of the imam. What should you do while the imam is away? Your duty in the absence of the imam is two things. One is called intidhar and the other is called taqiyah. Whilst you live in the under the rule of illegitimate usurpers, then you are under obligation to wait for the imam. You have no right to engage in political activity. You have to wait for the imam to come, because the imam teaches. Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq teaches and he says, كُلُّ رَايَةٍ, this hadith of the Shia once again, كُلُّ رَايَةٍ تُرْفَعُ قَبْلَ الْمَهْدِ أَوْ قَبْلَ الْقَائِمِ فَهِيَ رَايَةُ ضَلَالَةٍ وَصَاحِبُهَا طَاغُوتٌ يُعْبَدُ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ. Any standard that is raised, when you raise a standard, that means you start a rebellion, you start a revolt against the existing rulers. So any revolution that is instituted, any revolution that is initiated before the return of the Mahdi is misguidance. It's a revolution of misguidance, it's a revolution of dalal. And the one who is leading that revolution is a taghut. What's the meaning of the word taghut? Taghut means something extremely evil. He is an evil tyrant. He's not upon haqq, he's upon batil. He's not upon hidayah, he's upon dalala. وَصَاحِبُهَا, the one who raises such a standard and starts such a revolution, is a طَاغُوت يُعْبَدُ مِن دُونِ اللَّهِ, who is, that طَاغُوت is being worshipped besides Allah Ta'ala. Shirk is being done. Why? Because Allah has said, wait for the Mahdi to come. You have no right to engage in any kind of political activity. This has been the guiding light by which the Shia regulated their political lives ever since the disappearance of the Mahdi in 265, after which there was about 70 years of Ghaiba Sughra, during which they claimed that they had limited contact with the Mahdi, and then came about the Ghaiba Kubra in 327 after the Hijrah. From that day up to now, over 1100 years have passed and they still have no sign of it, but they say we have to continue making two things, taqiyya and intidhar. About taqiyya we spoke at length, where you dissimulate and you say things which you do not believe in order to protect yourself thereby. An entire lecture was devoted to that. Intidhar is the other thing that they were supposed to do. What is that? Wait. Wait for the Mahdi. Don't start anything while the Mahdi is not yet there. I want to read some of the ahadith of the Shia that says how the Imams instructed their followers to go about during this particular period. Muhammad ibn Abi Zainab al-Nu'mani. Muhammad ibn Abi Zainab al-Nu'mani was a Shi'i author who wrote a book on the ghiba, that means on the occultation of the Imam. In this particular book of his, he recalls, he writes as follows, إِنَّ أَمْرَ الْوَصِيَّةِ وَالْإِمَامَةِ بِعَهْدٍ مِّنَ اللَّهِ وَبِخْتِيَارِهِ. The matter of wasiyah and imamah. Wasiyah is when the previous imam appoints the next imam after him. And imama is when the person takes, the imam actually takes up the leadership. These things are not by election, he says. These things are only by Allah's selection. لا من خلقه ولا باختيارهم. It's not a matter for people to choose, the creation to choose themselves. فمن اختار غير مختار الله. Anyone who selects a ruler other than the one whom Allah Ta'ala has selected, وَخَالَفَ أَمْرَ اللَّهِ سُبْحَانَهُ وَرَدَ مَوْرِدَ الظَّالِمِينَ وَالْمُنَافِقِينَ الْحَالِينَ فِي نَارِهِ. You select any other ruler during a period while the imam is not there. You've selected the ruler other than the ruler that the imam, that Allah has appointed, then what will happen to you? You will go there where all the other ظالمين, all the other unjust and munafiqeen, hypocrites will go, that is to Jahannam. Under that, he mentions 17, that's a topic only, that's not a statement. That's the topic. Under that topic, there are 17 different ahadith in which he discusses why, in the period while the Imam is gone, the Shia are on obligation to make taqiyya and to engage in intidar. Wait for the Imam, but do not engage in any kind of activity. Not very long after him, Nu'mani died in the year 340. In 381, Saduq dies. Now this all in the 4th century, Saduq has a similar statement. Saduq says, he's speaking about the other side. The previous quotation spoke about intidar, wait for the new imam. This one speaks about taqiyya and he says, At-taqiyyatu faridatun wajibatun alayna fi dawlati al-zalimin. As long as the unjust ones are ruling, then taqiyya is wajib upon us. We have to continue making taqiyya. فَمَنْ تَرَكَهَا فَقَدْ خَالَفَ دِينَ الْإِمَامِيَّةِ وَفَارَقَهُ. If you abandon taqiyya, then you have gone against the religion of the imamiyya, that's the Shia, and you have parted ways with it. وَالتَّقِيَّةُ وَاجِبَةٌ لَا يَجُوزُ تَرْكُهَا. How long? Taqiyya is wajib, you cannot abandon it, not permitted for you, not lawful to abandon it, إِلَىٰ أَن يَخْرُجَ الْقَائِمُ, until the Mahdi appears again. فَمَنْ تَرَكَهَا فَقَدْ دَخَلَ فِي نَهْيِ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ وَنَهْي رَسُولِهِ وَالْأَئِمَّةِ عَلَيْهِمُ السَّلَامُ. Anyone who abandons taqiyya, he has done what? He has entered that which Allah has prohibited, which Rasul sallallahu alayhi wa sallam prohibited, and the a'imma have prohibited. وَيَجِبُ الْإِعْتِقَادِ أَنَّ حُجَّةَ اللَّهِ فِي أَرْضِهِ وَخَلِيفَتَهُ عَلَى عِبَادِهِ فِي زَمَانِنَا هَذَا هُوَ الْقَائِمُ الْمُنْتَظَرُ Ibn al-Hasan. Our Imam in this time, he says, that 381 he dies. So from the 3rd to the 4th century up to the 14th century, our Imam is the son of Al-Hasan Al-Askari. He is the Qa'im, the one who we are awaiting. وَيَجِبُ أَن يُعْتَقَدْ أَنَّهُ لَا يَجُوزُ أَن يَكُونَ الْقَائِمْ غَيْرَهُ. It cannot be anyone else. There can be no ruler but that Qa'im, but that Mahdi. And there are several ahadith of this kind as well. So this was the kind of political regime. The political regime that was imposed upon the Shia was to be apolitical, to withdraw completely, to be passive. Intidar and taqiyya. In the same time that these people are writing, the very same time that these people are writing, in Baghdad a certain development took place. In the year 132, the Abbasids came to power. 200 years later, the Abbasids were becoming weak. The Abbasid Khilafah was starting to totter. It was starting to crumble from the inside. So what happened was that a new dynasty, a Persian dynasty of local rulers, they came from Persia, they are called the Buwayhids or the Buyids. They came from Persia, they marched upon Baghdad and they took over Baghdad. They are the real rulers. The Khalifa is only a ruler in name. The Buwayhid Sultan, he is the real ruler. He is the one who says, he is the one who does. The Khalifa becomes a mere figurehead, a puppet in the hands of the Buwayhid ruler. These Buwayhid rulers were Shia. They were Shia and they ruled Baghdad like that for about a century. At the time when these Shia were making these statements that I'm reading about now, when these Shia scholars were making these statements, Baghdad was being ruled by a Shi'i. If the Shia had any idea of governing, of taking over the reins of governance, they had all the opportunity to do so under the Buwayhids. The Buwayhids gave the Shia scholars a free reign to live in Baghdad as they want to engage in debate as they want to teach and write their books. They had every kind of freedom under the Buwayhids. In fact, the Ahlul Sunnah, the ulama of the Ahlul Sunnah at that time suffered under the Shia Buwayhids. But what did the Shia do? They wrote, they debated, they did everything, but they did not take over the reins of government. Why did they not? Because in the absence of the Imam, the duty of a Shi'i is to be passive, to observe taqiyya, and to observe intidar. To wait for the imam, and to continue to dissimulate, not reveal your true beliefs. That's one example. That was in the 300s. We jump a few centuries, 4 centuries from there, we come to the 700s. In the 700s, for the second time, what eventually happened to the Buwayhids in Baghdad is 100 years later, they were supplanted and kicked out of Baghdad by a new dynasty. And this new dynasty was a Sunni dynasty, they were called the Seljuks. When the Seljuks came to Baghdad, the Shia were removed. So for 100 years, if not more, they had opportunity which they did not use. We can understand, we now understand why. But thereafter came, I'm jumping to what I said, the 700s, the 8th century, before I go there, in the 500s, in the 6th century, Something major happened, and that something major was the coming of the Mongols, of the Tatars, and the fall of Baghdad that occurred with the coming of the Tatars. Who is responsible for the fall of Baghdad? Who is responsible for the million, if not 2 million lives that were lost in what was probably one of the greatest slaughters of our Middle Ages? The story goes as follows, that there was a Shi'i alim, and this particular story is not sucked out of my thumb, it does not come from any Sunni source. It comes from the book Lu'lu'atul Bahrain of Sheikh Yusuf al-Bahrani in the biography of a person called Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi. This Khaja Nasiruddin Tusi, he says, was a young man studying Shia fiqh, studying the madhab of the Shia in his homeland, and at that time he conceived an idea. The idea that he conceived in his mind was, we have to bring an Alawi rule. We have to bring an Alawi ruler. We cannot have these Abbasids ruling us. We must have an Alawi ruler. Someone who's descended, not from Abbas, but from Ali ibn Abi Talib. And then he was an excellent scholar. In the sciences, in the arts, he was excellent. Somehow or the other, he found his way to one of the powers of the time. That power was the assassins. Now the original assassins. The word assassin today is descended from the Arabic word, taken from the Arabic word, the Hashashin. The Hashashin, they were a group of the Shia, of the Ismaili Shia. Of the Ismaili Shia, and they lived in a castle near the town of Qazvin called Alamut in northwestern Iran, that's where they had their stronghold. And they were an extremist sect of the Shia. They still continue up to the present day. They are still to be found, they are the followers of the Aga Khan. Sometimes you call them the Khojas. This particular group of Shia, they were living there, and they were running a reign of terror. They had the headquarters there, and the ruler and the head of the Shia there, the original head was a person called Hassan Sabbah. What they would do, they would drug the inmates, their followers there. They would drug them with what? With hashish. And we all know what hashish is. We have another word for it down here. Anyway, so they would drug them, and within the stronghold they would have gardens. In that gardens there would be maidens. And that these drug followers would be sent into those gardens and enjoy themselves with those maidens. Eventually when they come out of their drug state, they would be asked, you know where you went? Say, where? That was very enjoyable, but where was it? He said, that was paradise. If you want to go back to paradise, you obey me. Obey the ruler, obey the imam. And in that way, he recruited a group of followers that would do anything. You order him to go and kill so-and-so, he will do it. And what was the modus operandi? They would go, a certain scholar has been making too many statements about the Shia, they would send someone out to him. Not a quick job. For 5 years, 10 years, that person will become a student, live with him, become very close to him, and one day, when he finds the opportunity, he'll put a dagger through his heart. Those were the original assassins. Why were they called assassins? Because they used to smoke hashish. So they were called the Hashishiyin back then, and that's where the word assassin came from. Nasiruddin Tusi found that this is a power at the time. I should team up with them, perhaps through them we can reinstate an Alawi Khilafah. However, he miscalculated for the time being, because the rising power of the time was not the Hashishiyin. It was not the assassins. There was a new power that was rising, and that was the Mongols. It wasn't very long before the Mongols came and even destroyed the stronghold of the assassins. They entered it, and there they found this great Shia scholar, Nasiruddin Tusi. What did he do? He simply changed sides. He now joined Hulagu, the Mongol ruler, and whispered into his ears. He whispered into his ears, the prize to be taken is not the stronghold of the assassins. It's not Persia. The real prize of the Muslim world is Baghdad. Go to Baghdad and sack Baghdad. That is where you will really achieve what you are seeking. His objective can be achieved because thereby he removes the Abbasid ruler and he will be able to bring an Alawi ruler in its place. It did happen. And the blood flowed in Baghdad. And 1 million people lost their lives. And the rivers of Baghdad ran black with the blood of the books that were thrown into the river, into the water. But an Alawi Khilafah was not brought about. No Alawi Khilafah was brought about. The Mongols had no intention of bringing any Alawi ruler in. At that time, there was a leading Shia scholar, he was called Ibn Tawus. And Ibn Tawus, the Khalifa at the time, the last Khalifa, asked him, please, I ask you to become the Naqib al-Ashraf. just running over. To become the Naqib al-Ashraf, the head of the Ahlul Bayt organization that sees to all the needs of the Ahlul Bayt. He refused to become so. Why? Because he cannot accept any position from a usurper, a zalim and unjust ruler. But when Hulagu sacked Baghdad, and asked him to become the new head of the Ashraf, he said, by all means, welcome. He accepted the post because they were all looking forward to the day when we'll have a new ruler, when we can have our own Alawid ruler, we don't have to have these Abbasids any longer. But nothing came about. Nothing of that kind came about. Again, there was an opportunity. They actually worked for the opportunity, but then they dropped the opportunity. Why? Perhaps because of the realization that the role of the Shia is not to take the political reins in their hands, but rather to do what? Taqiyya and intidhar. You have to wait for the Imam. You cannot supersede. You cannot jump the gun. The Imam will come back. Perhaps in this way they were thinking that if they do destroy the Abbasid Khilafah, that will bring about the return of the Imam. Very similar to another group, the Zionists, the Christian Zionists, together with the Jewish Zionists. The Christian Zionists, from the Balfour Declaration onwards, why were there so many Europeans, specifically Englishmen, who were prepared to give Israel, to give the land of Palestine to the Zionists? Why were they? Because what did they want? They wanted exactly what is taking place now. There must be friction in the Holy Land. Blood must be spilled in the Holy Land in order to expedite the coming of Christ. Christ has to come back to the earth, and they wanted to expedite it in this particular way. So perhaps by the destruction of the Abbasid Khilafah, it was intended that now the time inside the Mahdi will come. The Mahdi did not come. And the fact that they thereafter did not stand up to take political control, that perhaps shows that the plan backfired. It did not work. That was in the 500s, in the 6th century. In the 8th century, not very long thereafter, in Iran, in the town of Sabzawar, in Iran, a group of Shia grabbed hold of the reins of government there and established a Shia state of their own. They were called the Sarbadaran. The Sarbadaran started a state of their own and said, this state we're going to make it a Shia state. We want no other madhab here, only the Shia madhab. But they had no Shia ulama, because the land of Iran had barely any Shia ulama at the time. So they looked around in the Muslim world in south, what is today South Lebanon, there where Hezbollah lives, Jabal Amil it used to be called in those days. They found that the leading Shia scholar of the time was a person called Muhammad ibn Makki al-Amili. The Shia call him al-Shahid al-Awwal, the first Shaheed. They call him the first Shaheed because this was a man who had grown up as a Shi'i, brilliant scholar, but now when the time comes for him to start teaching as a scholar, the Shia do not have madrasas, they do not have infrastructure of their own. So what he did was, he went to the town of Ba'labak in Lebanon, and he pretended to be a Sunni. He pretended to be a Sunni, in other words, he was making taqiyya. He was such a, he knew the madahi of the Ahlul Sunnah as well, and he knew the madhab of the Shia as well. So he could pretend. And he was appointed to the professorship of a madrasa in Ba'labak, where he continued teaching the four madhahib, and in between he would slip the Shia madhab in. At some point or the other he was found out and he was executed by the ruler of the city at the time. The Shia call him al-Shaheed al-Awwal, the first martyr. Anyway, at that time this person, al-Shaheed al-Awwal Muhammad ibn Makki al-Amili, he was invited to Iran. He was invited to Iran and told, come here and become what? Become the Shaykh al-Islam, become the Mufti, become the Qadi. We have a Shia state. What was his answer? No. Why was his answer no? Because it is not for us to establish an Islamic state while the Mahdi has not yet come. What should we do? Taqiyya, which he was doing very well, and intidhar. We have to wait for the Imam to come. You cannot take things into your own hands. And in this way it continued. We were there in the what? In the 8th century, 2 centuries later. One of the most momentous events in the history of Shiism would come about, and that is when the Safavids took control of Iran. Now the Safavids, they are the descendants of a Sufi Sheikh from Ardabil, Sheikh Safiyuddin Ardabili. Safiyuddin Ardabili was a Sunni, a Shafi'i, and a Sheikh of the Sufi Tariqah. His descendants, however, after him, converted to Shiism. And they converted the entire Sufi Tariqah to Shiism as well. And these were not just Sufis that would sit and make dhikr or anything like that. These were Sufis that would enter the battlefield if their master, their sheikh, their peer calls for it. So that's exactly what they did. They fought wars, they took control of the land of Iran, and then they started turning Iran into a Shia land. At that time, they did the same thing which the Sarbadars did before. They had no local scholars, so they invited Shia scholars from the Arab lands. There were no Shia scholars locally. In fact, it is said that when they looked around for books of the Shia, just books to teach them how to practice Shia fiqh, they could only find one book. All around they looked, they couldn't find anyone. So they had to import from the Shia, from the Arab lands. The Arab lands, there were about three different locations where you had Shia. You had Shia across the Persian Gulf in Bahrain, you had some Shia in Iraq, and then you had some Shia in what is today South Lebanon. So they invited them. What was the answer of those Shia ulama? By and large, almost without exception, they said no. Again, what was the reason? The reason was, it goes against the doctrine of taqiyya and intidhar. But one Shia alim differed. One Shia alim said, no, I'm going to take up this post of becoming Shaykhul Islam, becoming the chief religious officer in this newly founded Shia state. His name was Ali ibn Abdul Al al-Karaki. The Shia call him al-Muhaqqiq al-Karaki, and they generally know him as Murawijul Madhab, the one who popularized Shiism. Popularized it because it was not yet popular in Iran at the time. He made it popular. This person, his habit was, when he marches in a procession, in an official procession, his habit was that in front of him two persons must march. In front of him, two persons must march, and they will announce something. Their announcement is not to say that here comes the Shaykhul Islam. Their announcement is to rain curses upon Abu Bakr and Umar, nothing else. The Shaykhul Islam of Safavid Iran will march, and in front of him two persons will march, and all they will do is to rain curses of Abu Bakr and Umar, and the public, the people who had grown up as Ahlul Sunnah, who had grown up with the reverence and respect of the Sahaba in their heart, they would be tested in this way. What did they have to say? They cannot even stay silent. They cannot stay silent. Whenever the Sahaba are cursed, then they are called upon to respond by saying, Beshbad, let it be more, make even more curse. And if you don't respond in this particular way, then you see what happens to you. And this is how Iran was converted into a Shia land. This person, Ali al-Karaki, he saw an opportunity. He realized that the spread of Shiism will not come about if they keep to their own areas and keep maintaining the doctrines of taqiyya and intidhar. He saw that the land of Iran was ripe for conversion. The Sufi tariqah who had become Shi'i, the Safavids, their Shiism was a very, very strange kind of Shi'i. It wasn't run-of-the-mill Ithna Ashri Shiism. Their first leader was someone called Shah Ismail Safavi. Ismail ibn Haydar al-Safavi. He was regarded by his followers initially as God incarnate. They were the kind of Shia that would qualify as what? As Ghula. They were extremists. Gradually they brought that idea down. He's no longer God incarnate because he was defeated. You see, every battle that he entered, he was victorious. So this man can't be defeated. He must be someone great. He must be Allah, na'udhu billah. And then Sultan Salim, the Ottoman, Sultan Salim of the Ottoman Empire, attacked them. The reason why they attacked them, because they were fomenting revolution within the Ottoman territories. They had taken Iran, they had turned Ahlul Sunnah into Shia, and now they were fomenting revolution. And they killed a lot of people during that revolution. So Sultan Salim attacked them. And a battle took place at a place called Chaldiran. And in Chaldiran, Shah Ismail Safavi the Invincible was defeated. For the first time his followers realized, well, he wasn't so invincible after all. So they brought the status of it down. No, he is not God incarnate, but he is something else. He is the representative of the hidden Imam. So from extremist Shiism, now it starts becoming more moderate and made somehow or the other to fit in with classical Ithna Ashari Shiism. However, it was made to fit in with Ithna Ashari Shiism. This Shia alim was pragmatic. Ali al-Karaki was pragmatic. He realized, I'm going into something, these people are not proper Shia. but we can make them into proper Shia. And the others who are not Shia, who are still Sunni, we'll convert all of them to Shia as well. And through his efforts, gradually some of the other Shia ulama migrated to Iran. They migrated to Iran for the first time in history, in Shia history. There came about a nexus, a connection between the state and the clergy of the Shia. Before, the idea was what? We the Shia ulama have nothing to do with governments, because all governments are oppressors. All governments are usurpers. We don't have anything to do with governments. All that we are obliged to do is wait for the Mahdi and make taqiyah in the meantime. Now, for the first time, the Shia had a state. And not just a small state like the Sarbadars, not just a city and two villages around it, but they had the entire Persia, practically the whole of Iran today. They had it in front of them. They could do as they liked. And now Shia fiqh, Shia hadith developed in this period like never before, because of patronage that the state gave them. So there came about the nexus between the ulama and the government. Very, very closely connected to one another. However, after something like 250 years, the Safavi state crumbled. They were attacked by the Afghans under Mahmud Ghilzai. They were attacked by the Afghans and the Safavi state crumbled. The Safavi state crumbled, so where do the ulama go now? The ulama of the Shia of Iran, many of them now fled to Iraq, and they went to go and live in what they call are the shrine cities of Iraq. The shrine cities of Iraq are Najaf and Karbala and Samarra, where they believe the imams are buried. They went to go and live there. And there, what did they do? Like they used to have madrasas in Iran now they founded madrasas in those places. In Iran, a new dynasty took over. Under Nadir Shah, there was a new dynasty called the Afshari dynasty. And then they came afterwards the Qajar dynasty that ruled for the next few hundred years, 200-300 years about. In this time, the Shia ulama did not have that very close relationship with government as before. They still had a good relationship, but not as close as the Safavids. The Safavids depended for their legitimacy upon the ulama. The ulama depended for their position upon the Safavids. It was a mutual coexistence. The one needed the other. You wash my back and I'll wash yours. So when that state crumbled, the ulama, the Shia ulama now had to find something else. In this period, what they discovered is that they do have an alternative. They do have an alternative. What is that alternative? They don't need a state to survive. They have something else. They have the Khumus to survive on. Because in the 200-300 years of Safavid coexistence, they realized that one-fifth that the Shia have to pay towards the Imam, they still have to pay it. It's important they must pay it. But where will it go? There's no Imam to give it to. There is an Imam, but we don't know quite where he is. So in the meantime, they must pay it to the representative of the Imam. If the Imam is not here, then pay it to his representative. The idea came about now of representation of the hidden Imam. So while the state and the government cooperated, the government said, you know, we are a legitimate government. What makes us legitimate? The Imam said we are legitimate. Which Imam? Imam Mahdi. But where is he? Well, he couldn't be here himself, unfortunately, but his representative said that we are a legitimate government. So the Shia ulama, the clergy, gained an independent base of power. And when the Safavid state crumbled, they still had the independent base of power. Then came the Qajars. And the Qajars ruled for quite a while, but not with that close operation any longer. And then came the age of colonialism. And colonialism did many things. Colonialism did so many things that just to recount them will take a long time. One of the important things which it did is when the colonialists entered our countries, they destroyed whatever systems they were and they took them over. And when they left those countries, they left Western civilization in its wake. So, very soon you found that the Ottoman Empire crumbled. There's no Khilafah left any longer. The Mughal Empire crumbled. There's no Mughal Empire left any longer. All the kingdoms of Southeast Asia crumbled. Those were taken away as well. All political structures were removed. We found ourselves, when the colonialists left our countries, we find that we no longer had something called the Darul Islam. I'm not speaking about this masjid here. I'm speaking about the land of Islam that was this huge tract of land once upon a time. It might have been divided into different geographical areas, but it was one great Darul Islam. We no longer had the Darul Islam, we had nation states. The colonialists came and took a pen and drew a line and said, this land of Syria, draw a line like this and a line like this. That's called Jordan, that's called Palestine, that's called Syria, that's called Lebanon. Take another line, draw it there and say that's called Morocco and that's called Libya. Anyway, we were just divided into small little countries. There's a Malaysia, there's an Indonesia, and there's a Singapore. There's an India, and there's a Pakistan, and there came a Bangladesh afterwards. Everything was divided in these ways, just by the draw of a pen. So we found ourselves in an age of nationalism, in an age of all kinds of isms that the West had developed and grown tired of, they'd offloaded onto us. And every country, كُلُّ حِزْبٍ بِمَا لَدَيْهِمْ فَرِحُونَ, everyone reveled in who we are. The Egyptian walked around saying, نَحْنُ أَبْنَاءُ الْفَرَاعِنَ. No longer said that we are the people where Amr ibn al-As established Islam. No, we are the children of Fir'aun. And everyone went about claiming ancient roots and we are the most ancient civilization on earth and so on. We can see it. Africa is going the same direction now. Everyone wants to be the cradle of civilization. It's a new renaissance. Anyway, so the Muslim world were in a similar position. The Qajar dynasty was also very, very weak at the time. And had also become compromised to Western powers. Most specifically, the two major superpowers at the time. Who were those two superpowers? It was the UK and the USSR. It's England, it's Britain on the one hand, and it's Russia on the other. America was still standing out of the water at the time. First World War and so on, these were the two great powers. Now, the Russians, their sphere of influence was the north of Iran. Because right north of Iran is Azerbaijan, and that those are territories conquered by the Russians and Uzbekistan and everything else. And from the south, here from India-Pakistan side and the Gulf, these were the British coming from this side here. So they drew a line and they said, our sphere of influence is the south, your sphere of influence is the north. And business concessions were being given to Western companies. Most importantly, in 1908, something was discovered in Iran and that thing is oil. And where oil is discovered, we know what happens next. Because industrialization of the West, when the West became industrialized and things are running on machines, it's been 100 years and they still haven't found an alternative. Oil is what they require. And it just so happens that Allah Ta'ala did not bless the West with all of that oil. It happens that the countries blessed with the oil are our countries. It's a good thing, it's a very bad thing too. Because it leads to interference. In 1908 it was discovered. Oil was discovered in Iran. And they came about a company called the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. And the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company will have rights on oil, all rights on oil exploration in Iran. 1925, a new ruler took over. The last of the Qajars was Ahmad Shah Qajar. And he was a very weak ruler. There were several revolutions against him. But he had a very able commander. And his commander was called Reza Khan. And this Reza Khan, he put down every revolution. He quelled every revolution. When he saw that I'm very powerful, the poor king can barely stand on his own 2 feet, he felt to himself, why can't I become the ruler? So he deposed the last ruler and he himself became the new emperor. So we had the Safavid Empire, then we had the Afshar Empire, then we had the Qajar, now we found a new one, the Pahlavi Empire. Founded by who? Reza Shah. Reza Shah was Reza Khan, he changed his name now to Reza Shah. And he changed the name of Iran too. Up to that point everyone spoke about Persia. He said, from today we are no longer Persia, we are Iran. And he started modernizing his country. He became the ruler in 1925. Now 1925, at the same time more or less, someone else was becoming a ruler somewhere else. In Turkey, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk was becoming, 1924 the Khilafah was abolished. And Atatürk started on his westernization program. At that time there was something which the Iranians called afterwards Gharb Zadagi. Gharb Zadagi, but you can also say in Afrikaans, Westverskruk. Everything, you see the West has something, oh no, they have advanced, there's progress there. If we want to progress, we have to do exactly the same as they. So, our legal systems have to be changed to the same as their legal systems. To the extent, everyone knows about what Mustafa Kemal Atatürk did. What did he do? He prohibited people from wearing Islamic dress. You have to wear a suit and a hat. And women have to wear costumes as they are wearing in the West. Reza Shah did the same thing in Iran. He did the same thing. Women who are walking, you see the Iranian women wear those big chadors. Up to today you see them wearing it. He sent his police out into the street. Any woman that you see wearing a chador, you tear it off her body. And he openly took on a class within Iranian society that had discovered its own power not too long before that. That was the ulama. The ulama had realized that they're an extremely important cog within Iranian society's machine, and they also have a say. And they realized that the kind of reforms that Reza Shah is bringing about, those reforms will deprive us of our privileged position within the society. Now, we can empathize and sympathize with some of those ideas that they had. Because when you see your Sharia getting attacked, when you see it getting undermined, when you see it getting removed from the lives of society, you will respond. And the ulama responded. But Reza Shah responded against them with violence. With violence, and no one was allowed to open his mouth. However, he miscalculated too. He miscalculated because he became the king in 1925. In 1939, something happened, and that was the First World War. The First World War, on the one side, you found Britain and its allies with Russia, and on the other side, there was Germany and its allies. So he did not quite like the British. He did not quite like the Americans. He had a soft spot for Germany and Italy and France. He rather wanted their influence. It is said that he was quite an admirer of Adolf Hitler. Allahu A'lam. But in any event, he didn't want British influence. He wanted assistance from the West, but not from Britain. He wanted it from where? From Germany. So, 1939, the war starts. By 1941, Germany decides to attack Russia. When Germany attacks Russia, remember, Iran is still under the influence of both Russia and Britain. So Russia and Britain make a demand upon him. Kick out all German citizens out of your country. He refuses to do so. The result is, they sent in troops. He was forced to abdicate, kicked out from his post. He was sent away to Johannesburg in exile. 1941, Reza Shah came to South Africa. He sat in exile in Johannesburg. The house where he was kept in exile still belongs to the Iranian government up to today. Anyway, he came to Joburg, and he sat in Joburg for a while, and his son was brought into power. This whole stratagem, this wasn't about kicking out the German nationals. It was more about the greed that Russia and Britain had for Iranian oil. And they knew that he was going to bring in more German, French and Italian influence. They did not want that. They wanted the lion's share of the oil. Not just the lion's share, they wanted it all. So they contrived a way to get rid of him, and they brought this complacent young man called Muhammad Reza Pahlavi, his son, they brought him into power. That was in 1941. Now, what has been happening? The father has been attacking religion. At that time, there was a young Shi'i alim living in the city of Qum. This alim was born in the year 1902. So in 1941, he was 39 years old. Old enough to understand what's happening around him. This young man was called Ruhullah Khomeini. He saw what was happening. He saw the kind of things that the Shah was doing at the time. But at that time, he had no interest in politics. At that time, he was just another Shi'i alim who was defending Shi'ism and attacking the Sahaba radiallahu anhum and attacking the Quran. His book that he wrote at the time was called Kashful Asrar. If you read Khomeini in Kashful Asrar, it's a far cry from the Khomeini that the world would know afterwards. That's the Khomeini that still makes the Sahaba kafir and still say that the reason why Allah does not mention the names of the Imams in the Quran is that had he mentioned it, the Sahaba would have taken it out, so he thought better rather not mention it. That's that Khomeini. And that time, that was his level of involvement. No politics whatsoever. But the father is gone. 1941, Khomeini is about 40 years old. Just 39, 40 years old. He is not interested in politics. The son takes over in 1941. For 10 years, the son is a puppet in the hands of the Americans, the British, and the Russians. In 1951, 10 years after him being in power, a new government, still the same Shah, but a new government takes over in Iran. New government. There's a politician called Muhammad Musaddiq. Muhammad Musaddiq becomes a prime minister. And Musaddiq leads a movement for what? He became a prime minister on what ticket? What did he tell the people? What will he give them? Nationalization of the Iranian oil, kicking out of the British, kicking out of the Americans. We don't want them. We don't want them. We want Iranian oil to be for Iranians. Like South Africans would ask, South African gold must be for South Africans, not for Anglo-American that's listed on the London Stock Exchange. Any event. So they're asking, Iran Its oil must be for Iranians. The Shah is a very pliant puppet in the hands of the US and the UK and everyone else. He had gotten rid of the Soviets by then, because remember, this was now the time of the Cold War. After the Second World War ends in 45. There starts the Cold War between the Americans and the Russians, the West and the Russians. So the Cold War, they convince him to take sides with them. He was a very, very devoted servant of the West, Muhammad Reza Pahlavi. On the one side, he was that, so he got rid of the communists and the Russians. On the other side, he continued his father's reforms. Before we get there though, nationalization, Mossadegh is calling for nationalization. Mossadegh calls for nationalization, and on that ticket he becomes a prime minister. From 51 to 53 he rules. Then the CIA organized a coup d'etat. They call it Operation Ajax. A coup d'etat. In this coup d'etat, they send in operatives of the CIA, of MI6, and Muhammad Mossadegh is arrested. He's put into house arrest till the end of his life. The Shah, when Mossadegh was president, was prime minister, the Shah had to flee. He was out of the country. Now they brought him back in power. Don't you worry, we're standing behind you. The CIA's involvement in Iran led to a great degree of dissatisfaction of the Iranian people, not just the ulama. There were communists within Iranian society. There were ulama within Iranian society. There were Western secularists in Iranian. There was a whole lot of a spectrum of different kind of people. But all of them, by and large, except for the very, very extremely Westernized ones, were upset with the turnover, with the manner in which the nationalization project of Mossadegh was overturned. Because what happens now? Anglo-Iranian oil has all the oil rights back once again. And the Shah was brought in. The Shah becomes an extremely hated figure. He becomes a hated figure because of what he had done. Iranian oil was for Iranians, and now where is it? 1963. The Shah starts a new program. He called it the White Revolution, in which he takes his father's westernization, modernization project further. Women's rights, change of laws, clothing, and all those other things together with it. But one alim decides to open his mouth about it. And that alim, now he is a 60-year-old person called Ruhullah Khomeini. No longer 40 years old, he's 60 years old. I'm sketching this against the backdrop of what's happening in Iran. You can understand what the dissatisfaction that not just Khomeini had, the entire Iranian society has. Does it stem from Shiism? It stems from events as they are unfolding with time. So Khomeini sits in Qum. He calls all the senior ulama together and he delivers a lecture. He delivers a lecture in which he calls upon the government to stop these reforms, and he draws a parallel between who? Muhammad Reza Pahlavi and Yazid ibn Muawiyah. He's as bad as Yazid was. Now this resonates well with the Shia. They understand exactly what you are talking about when you say this man is a Yazid. Because every year they hear the stories about Yazid on the 10th of Muharram. There's pandemonium in Iran. Absolute pandemonium. The Shah comes to Qum himself on that day. The next day, after Khomeini delivers his lecture, he comes himself with a battalion of soldiers. And what does he do? He condemns the ulama and he attacks the ulama and calls them leeches who live off the blood of the people, because the ulama received the khums, remember? So he attacks them in the weakest spot. Khomeini doesn't keep quiet. What does Khomeini do? Not very long thereafter, in the Madrasa Faiziyah, he does another lecture of a similar kind. What happens? What happens? He gets locked up. He gets put into house arrest. After a while, he is released. But while he was in house arrest, there were riots in Iran, riots in the city of Tehran. 400 people died. Iran is boiling. Iran is getting ready for something great that's going to happen not very long thereafter. This was in 1963. 1964, new legislation gets passed. This new legislation says that if any American soldier does anything wrong in this country here, he won't be tried by the local courts, he'll be tried by American courts. The Iranians say this cannot be. This is a slap in our face. This is trampling upon our dignity. They do something in our country and we can't try them for it, we can't take them to court for it. Again, Khomeini opens his mouth. The president, the prime minister at the time, is a person called Hassan Ali Mansour. He called for Khomeini to be brought to his office. He asked him, please, tone down your criticism. Shut your criticism or else. Khomeini refuses. What does he do? He slaps Khomeini in the face. The prime minister of the country slaps Khomeini in the face. Khomeini takes a slap. 2 weeks later, the president is assassinated. The country is going further and further towards the brink of either revolution or civil war. So they decide something needs to be done. Khomeini is a troublemaker. So they exile him to Iraq. And he goes to Iraq and first to Turkey, the city of Bursa in Turkey, just for about a year. From there they say, send him to Iraq. Let him stay in Najaf and teach. He's an alim, let him teach. In Iraq, sitting there in Iraq, now for the first time in the year, he was exiled to Iraq in the year 65. 5 years later, sitting in Iraq, he starts delivering lectures on the topic of politics in Islam. How is government supposed to be run? In the absence of a hidden imam, what are the ulama supposed to do? Now for the first time he comes up with the idea that in the absence of the imam, the ulama become the representatives of the imam. They must take the reins of government and run the state themselves. At this moment he was purely theoretical. He's sitting there teaching all of these things. Now these things are a bit worrisome to everyone. Sometimes you think, okay, this is a scholar, but this scholar has a history. He has a history as a troublemaker. What do we do with him? So by 1978, the vice president of Iran, oh, of Iraq, he's living in Iraq now, the vice president of Iraq contacts him. The vice president of Iraq tells him, look, I think you'd rather leave Iraq. Go somewhere else. That vice president would the next year become the president. And Khomeini would the next year become the head of Iran. That was Saddam Hussein. He told him, get out from Iraq, go somewhere else. So he took a tourist visa and he went to France. He stayed in France for about 4 months. And by that time, Iran was boiling over. When Iran was boiling over, there's something we need to understand about the Shia people, of the Iranian people. The Iranian people have always been very devoted to kings. They have to have the symbol, this figurehead at the top. They had their kings in the days before Islam. Reza Shah, when he was crowned as king, one of his anti-Islamic moves that he made was that he said, we're using the what calendar? The Hijri calendar? We're not using the Hijri calendar any longer. I am the last in a long line of Persian kings that we had that predates Islam by 1,000 years. We're starting a new calendar, the old Persian calendar, the old solar Persian calendar, and you say we are now in the year 2500 and something. So they always had this idea of kings, and they had the idea of descendants of kings and bloodlines. See, there's a certain reverence for bloodlines. Once they find a, they can identify well with a figurehead. Once that figurehead is there, Iran was boiling. Iran was boiling, but how many different elements are boiling within that pot? They are the communists. They are the Mujahideen Khalq. What shall we say? Neo-socialist communist kind of Islamic organization. On the other hand, they are the ulama. They are the traders. They are the intellectuals. They are the socialists. A whole lot of different people. Not a single one of them can offer a leader that everyone can accept. Only the ulama could offer that leader. Who was he? Ruhullah al-Khomeini. And everyone said, there's a leader upon whom we, you know, a symbol that we can take. Why? Because the ulama have traditionally had respect from the Iranian public, and he's a descendant of the imams and all of those other things in its place. So they invited Khomeini, come back. The Shah is about to flee the country. You come back, we need a leader. Khomeini flies in the year 1979, and that heralds the revolution. The revolution, however, is this melting pot in which all these various different elements have come together. The Shah is gone. What next? Everyone had, there was one element only that they had in common. The Shah was a bad ruler. The Shah's secret police, the Savak police, tortured people. The Shah was against Islam. The Shah had sold out to the West. The Shah killed, it's a whole list of complaints. The Shah sold out Iranian oil, and the list goes on. So when everyone has the same agenda of removing the Shah, that's all well and good. But when the Shah is gone, then what happens next? This is where everyone else miscalculated, and Khomeini knew what he was doing. The moment he was in power, he put in place his theory, which he had been crafting since 1965 in Najaf. What theory was that? Wilayatul Faqih. Wilayatul Faqih means the authority to rule of who? Whose authority? The jurist, the faqih, the alim. In the absence of the imam, the alim's duty is not simply to give fatwa. The alim's duty is not simply to lead the salah. The alim's duty is not simply to collect the khumus, etc. The alim's duty is to take over the reins of government. And then he set himself up,
Because the next logical question is, well, who is that alim going to be? Because there's a whole lot of claimants. Everyone will claim, I'm the best qualified. He said, well, I'm the one in power, everyone invited me, so I'm the man. Iranian government from that moment run like this. Right at the top there's the Wali Faqih. The Wali Faqih is a jurisprudent, no one can question him. He is the representative of the Imam. The authority that he brings with him is the same as the authority of the Imam. Under him there will be the government, the president, and the majlis, which is the parliament. All of those structures are there. Those neo-democratic structures are there. But right at the top there is a theocratic thing in place. And that is the place of the Wali Faqih. So what started happening now, everyone else thought, we gambled but we lost. We brought him in, we thought he'll be a unifying figure. Suddenly we find that he's not a unifying figure. What is he? He's a usurping figure. Now remember, the intellectuals, the technocrats, the bureaucrats, they say, we know how to govern. What does he know? He's a sheikh. So the problems start between them. The first ones he goes for are the who? The communists. The communists, the two-day party in Iran, they persecute them. The others that he starts going for at that time, now they were Sunni minorities, far in the east and far in the west, in Balochistan and Kurdistan. Those people had joined the revolution. And they were given the assurances by Khomeini, join us and you will have your rights. When they saw they were not being given their rights, they said, why did we fight? Why did we face the bullets and the tanks of the Shah? Why did we do all of this? Just to have a new tyrant ruling us from Tehran now? So the tanks get sent into Kurdistan and Balochistan once again, and the people start suffering. They haven't stopped suffering. Up to the present day, they continue suffering as a minority in Iran. So he goes for all his opponents. All his opponents gradually start going for them. In the meantime, the West is perturbed at what's happening. We had the hostage crisis where the American embassy was stormed and they held them hostage. The West was appalled at what's happening. Look at this. We didn't know this was going to happen because they hadn't been keeping track of Khomeini's thought. They thought this is just a scholar sitting in the middle of nowhere, twiddling his thumbs about books and so on. They didn't know that he was a scholar with an agenda. And there were people that were prepared to support him to death. So they arranged that his old friend there from Iraq who kicked him out of the country, Saddam Hussein, must attack him. The Iran-Iraq war started then. For 8 years they fought a war. They thought they will do what? They thought they will destroy Iran. They did not destroy Iran. Rather, they galvanized the Iranian spirit. They galvanized because the Iranians now gave martyrs after martyrs after martyrs in that particular war. The young children, young boys, would march into battlefield to set off the landmines. And they were told, do that, Jannah is yours. And thereafter the stormtroopers would come in. So these things happen. They don't kill a nation. They don't kill, they galvanize, they make that nation stronger. So instead of making them weaker, they miscalculated once again. The Iranians just gained more and more resolve. And they went ahead with their particular projects. Khomeini comes into power when? 1979. 1991, the next leg in the development of his theory of Wilayatul Faqih now comes about. Originally he said the Imam has what power? The Imam must rule in the place of the Faqih must rule in the place of the Imam. They came about, Iranian law is made like this. By us, how is law made? Parliament makes the law. By them, a law is made in this way. Parliament doesn't make a law, Parliament suggests a law. Parliament suggests a law, that law goes to a committee called the Committee of Experts, Majlis-e-Khubragan. It goes to the Majlis-e-Khubragan, they look at it and say, this is either in line with our fiqh or not in line with our fiqh. If it's not in line with our fiqh, we kick it out. So there was a dispute about the minimum wage. Parliament made a law which says that workers must be paid specific. We have something similar, you know, domestic workers, you can't pay beneath it. They made a law like that. Parliament made the law, the experts committee kicked it out. They say, no, this is not in line with our fiqh. We can't have a minimum wage. So the rule is, when that happens, parliament on the one side, the experts on the other side, then they will take that law and refer it to the man at the top, that's Khomeini. They refer it to him, he does not agree with the experts, he agrees with the parliament, with the majlis. He says, we can have a law like this. The committee of experts are up in arms. The true position of the Wali Faqih. The Wali Faqih is not just the mufti who gives fatwa. The position of the Wali Faqih is such that if tomorrow he says stop praying and stop giving zakah and stop making hajj, you have to do so. His power is not just the power of an ordinary faqih. All of you have misunderstood. This is the real power of the Wali Faqih. The very next day, the head of the Majlis Khubragan, Ayatullah Lutfullah Safi Gulpaigani, resigns in protest. Because why? What did he realize? He realized this is not just Shia fiqh now. Khomeini has taken things to a different level altogether. He's taken it to a level unprecedented in the history of Shiism. There's never been such a thing. Because what was all along the theory? All along, our ulama were teaching us to make taqiyya and intidhar. For 1,000 years we made taqiyya and intidhar. Then Iran boiled. Colonialism, oil, British, American interference, nationalization, the Shah, everything. It caused the pot to boil and explode. And then suddenly we found ourselves with a new system called Wilayatul Faqih. We didn't even recognize it. It doesn't exist in our legacy. But then we accepted it because it was good for Iran at the time. Now we suddenly realize that no, we did not know what we got ourselves into. This is not just a faqih sitting at the head of affairs. This is a person making and breaking Allah's law as he feels fit. Because he is la yus'alu amma yaf'al. You can't ask him, what does he do? He is not responsible to you. He can suspend the entire parliament just by a flick of a pen. He can make law and break law just by snapping his fingers. This is what this is all about. This is what Wilayatul Faqih is. This is what the political system of Iran is all about. Therefore, many ulama in Iran had problems with it. One of the main ones that had a problem with it was Khomeini's own anointed successor. A man who had been with him in the years of exile in Iraq. Ayatollah Hussein Ali Muntaziri. He was Khomeini's anointed successor. He was the man who would have taken over if Khomeini dies. But here was a man of conscience. Here was a man of conscience, and he wrote Khomeini a letter. Khomeini was like his father. He's a student, Khomeini is the teacher. Khomeini is now already where? In his 80s, he was about 86 when he died. In his 80s, and his student, Muntaziri, realizes what we spoke about once upon a time and what's happening now is not the same. This is not what we fought for. This is not what we struggled for. So he writes Khomeini a letter and he says, you know, back in the Shah's days, the Savak, who was the Iranian secret service, the Iranian secret police, the jails were bad. The jails of the Savak were bad. Your jails are even worse. The amount of dissidents that are being tortured in your jails, the amount of innocent people that are being killed in Iran, this is not what we fought for. Khomeini wrote to him and said, you don't know what Wilayatul Faqih is all about. You are dismissed from your position. From that time, he was kept in house arrest. He died a few weeks ago while we were sitting and having a lecture. Yeah, he just died not too long ago. Right now, that discontent against Khomeini's idea of Wilayatul Faqih is boiling in Iran at this very present moment. Between who? Not between liberals or non-ulama and ulama, between ulama themselves. There are ulama on this side and ulama on that side. Things are still changing. To come back to what I was speaking about before, the idea was everyone thought, at this time, you know, who is there that would give leadership to the Muslim world? Who is there? Look at the Arab states. You find very little to write home about when you look at the leaders in the Arab world. When you look at them, you find pusillanimous rulers without spines. Spineless rulers who cannot stand up. Forget standing up to the West. They pander to the West. When you look at them, you say, well, not much to be proud about. You look at Iran, and then you see this resolute country that's standing against the West. It goes ahead with its nuclear program, no matter what, and it is attractive. Because it shows, it projects an image of what a Muslim should be. Stand up against the West. My submission here tonight is that that is the result of circumstances. That says nothing about what Shiism is all about. Shiism has been teaching taqiyya and intidhar. Don't get involved in politics. What's happening in Iran right now? They want to get rid of the system of Wilayatul Faqih. Who wants to get rid of it? The ulama themselves want to get rid of it because they see where it has led them to. Iran is a country in turmoil once again. It's taken 30 years to get there, but it's in turmoil once again. Anyone who's going to make up his mind of what is correct aqidah, anyone who's going to decide what is correct aqidah based upon Iran today and its political position in the world is being very, very short-sighted and myopic. Aqidah doesn't depend upon who is the right, who is the government that stands up to whoever. The West is our enemy today. The West is put it against us because of colonialism and everything that happened thereafter. But if we should judge the truth and correctness and veracity of a system of aqidah just based upon who is giving resistance, then in Salahuddin's time, who would have been right? Ahlul Sunnah would have been right there because Salahuddin kicked out the Crusaders. And then today,
would today the haq be on the side of? No, haq is not like that. Haq doesn't follow who stands up against who. Haq is decided in a completely different way. Allah Ta'ala will use those of His servants in a particular time for whatever purposes He wishes to. That is not to be taken as a sign of haq. What did Allah Ta'ala say about Baytul Maqdis? بَعَثْنَا عَلَيْهِمْ عِبَادًا لَنَا أُولِي بَأْسٍ فَإِذَا جَاءَ وَعْدُ أُولَاهُمَا. Now who was upon haq in that time? In the time of Bani Israel. In the time of Bani Israel, who was upon haq? Bani Israel had the haq of the Anbiya. They had the Anbiya amongst them. They had Dawood, they had Sulaiman, before that there was Sayyidina Musa, and they had more Anbiya than anyone else. So in terms of scripture, in terms of what is real haq, they had haq in their hands. Whether they were following it or not, that's a different matter. But when Allah Ta'ala said, Bani Israel will make fasad fil ard. Twice they will create great mischief in the land. And when the first of those occasions come about, then Bukhtanasar, Nebuchadnezzar of the Assyrians, the Babylonians, I'm sorry, he will come down upon Baytul Maqdis and destroy it. Ba'athna alaykum ibadan lana. They will be slaves of ours, uli ba'sin shadeed. They are slaves of Allah. That doesn't mean they were upon haq. They were given victory. That doesn't mean that they were upon haq. When the Crusaders took Baytul Maqdis and held it for almost 100 years, 90 years, does that mean Christianity was right, Islam was wrong? When colonialism came about and practically ruled the Muslim world for 300-400 years, ruled from where once upon a time the Amir al-Mu'mineen sat, when Allenby walked into Jerusalem, when General Allenby walked into Damascus, and walked up to the grave of Salah ad-Din and told him that today the Crusades have ended, O Salah ad-Din. Does that mean that Islam was not upon the haq any longer? So political victory does not mean haq. Haq is that haq which came with Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wasallam, which was passed along through the Sahaba tabi'een, generation after generation of Muslims, whether we were in the ascendancy or whether we were at the bottom. Making up one's mind as to what is haq and what is batil, simply on the basis of, you know, who is politically ascendant and who projects the right image about Islam, that is immature, that is short-sighted, that is myopic, that's the kind of thought that will lead you into the kind of batil that some of our youth unfortunately are falling into. What will happen if 10 years, 20 years or 100 years from now that is no longer the case? What if another Muslim country then becomes the one that stands up for Muslims worldwide? What will then happen? Will those ones change their opinion once again? No, once upon batil, Allah writes hidayah for whoever He wants to. And if Allah Ta'ala has written for someone to go off hidayah, then these reasons are created for them and they go on account of that. However, the point of our lesson tonight is that haq is not to be decided in terms of politics. Politics is sometimes this way, sometimes that way. When Abu Sufyan was asked by Heraclius went to Sham. Abu Sufyan went to Sham on trade, and then he met the Roman king there, because the Roman king Heraclius had just received a letter from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam inviting to Islam. Aslim taslam fa in abayta fa alayka ifmul arisiyin. He had received that letter from Rasulullah sallallahu alaihi wasallam, so he wanted to know who is this. So he said, is there anyone here from those lands? He said, yes, there's a caravan. They call them and say, who is the spokesperson? Abu Sufyan is the spokesperson. So he asked him, كَيْفَ الْحَرْبُ بَيْنَكُمْ? How is warfare between the two of you? His opponent says, الْحَرْبُ بَيْنَنَا سِجَالْ يَنَالُ مِنَّا وَنَنَالُ مِنْهُ. One day we win and one day they win. They won at Badr, we won at Uhud. So if haq was to be decided by who wins and who loses, then in Badr we were the winners, in Uhud they were the winners. Not to be decided by that. Haq is that haq for which you have to answer to Allah Ta'ala one day. Haq is that haq which is in the Quran and the Sunnah. Which form in the Quran and the Sunnah? Not twisted, not turned, not taken out of context, but as it stands there in the authentic Sunnah and in the Quran, which was preserved by the Sahaba radiallahu anhum, by Abu Bakr, Umar and Uthman, by Zayd ibn Thabit and the other Sahaba, preserved for us thereafter by the Tabi'een, the Imma, up to our own Tuanguru, who wrote this Quran sitting in exile in that island called Rabal Island, and he wrote 2 or 3 copies of the Quran from memory. This is how we preserve haq. Whether we are ruling or whether we are in exile, haq is preserved in this way. That is where haq lies. Wa akhiru da'wana and alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen wa sallallahu wa sallam ala sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi wa sahbihi wa tabi'in. Organizations and what they are doing and allegations about how things are going about. I think people need to be mature about this. People need to know who do you entrust with your funds and what they are doing with it. If it is true
that there are people who are abusing the institution of zakah and sadaqah for the purposes of proselytization and converting people to their madhab, then that should, number one, that should be made clear. Second, the public should be made aware thereof. And thereafter, once the public has been made aware and warned against it, then it's each man for himself, he makes his own decision. If anyone thereafter decides that he wants to give his money there, well, he needs to live with that decision and all the consequences of it. If something goes wrong in the society afterwards, of the kind of things which we have ominously predicted here, he is part of the problem, he has contributed towards it. We don't have executive power, enforcement power, whereby you can say, you know, I've told you not to give it, you're not going to, and you have to abide, or else. We don't have the else. We can say, don't do it. The else part of it, I think Pagar is more schooled in that part. We don't know much about how to enforce. Therefore, the most that we can say is at the level of the person's conscience. He must be made aware of the fact that what you are doing, you can do it through other organizations equally well. And if it's true that the Zakah Fund is cooperating with organizations without knowing what they are doing, then it should be brought to their notice as well. And thereafter, their decision must be taken by them. They must hold responsibility for it. They must take responsibility for it. That's the most that we can do. Clarify it, warn against it, sketch the future, give a picture of what will happen if it doesn't come about. And then it's each man to make his own conscience-based decision. That's as much as I can see into it. There might be others who can see sides to it which I cannot, produce better solutions than what I can think. I'm thinking on my feet as I'm sitting here. I don't think it's the ultimate solution. There might be better solutions. That's as much as I'm prepared to say about it for now.
Any other questions, brothers, sisters? Anybody else? The lady side? No. I will allow you normally one question, but please allow you another one, seeing nobody asks questions.
As a suggestion, excellent. I think though that people like Sheikh Irfan are in a much better position to comment upon that than when I am. I'll say that this particular desk can speak from here. When it comes to activism, there's few that can beat Sheikh Irfan. Barakallahu fi.